EFA.org. The time is 5 p.m. Stay tuned next for Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, we remember the life of Hugo Pinnell, a member of the San Quentin Six, who was killed yesterday during a prison riot at New Folsom Prison in California. Then, the Connecticut Supreme Court rules that 11 inmates cannot be executed, reaffirming that the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. In the wake of the Animas toxic river spill by the Environmental Protection Agency, a federal judge just ruled to allow the resumption of uranium mining in the Grand Canyon, considered not only one of the most endangered sites in the world, but also to be sacred land by the Havasupai First Nation tribe. Then, we continue our coverage of the fallout left in the wake of the violence and irregularities this past Sunday during parliamentary elections in Haiti. Finally, we bring you a special report by Nora Barrows-Friedman and the Electronic Intifada. I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Breaking news today, Hugo Yogi Pinnell has been killed in a prison conflagration. It's not clear what the details are. Apparently, he was stabbed by another inmate. He was in Folsom, California. To provide some context, let's listen to the official version of the circumstances behind the killing of Hugo Pinnell, given by Lieutenant Aaron Conrad, Public Information Officer for the California Department of Corrections.
We had a riot that occurred in Facility B, Main Exercise Yard, that involved 70 inmates. The cause of the riot is under investigation. Staff had utilized less lethal munitions to quell the riot, which lasted around 20 minutes. Additionally, three warning shots from Mini-14s were fired. Several inmates were injured. One inmate is deceased as a result of stab wounds from other inmates. His name is being withheld due to the till his next of kin has been notified. 11 inmates were taken to outside hospitals for treatment and for stab wounds and other injuries. Inmates with minor injuries are being treated within the facility. Staff have recovered several inmate manufactured weapons. No staff are injured. Inmate movement and programming are limited to facilitate the ongoing investigation.
Lieutenant, can you tell us how this started? Was it race-related?
I can't answer that at this time. Our investigative services unit is reviewing the video and collecting evidence within the facility.
Have you guys been noticing anything building up to this riot?
When you say that there was a limited activity, is that a lockdown, or how are you going to describe that? Are they being confined to their cells?
They'll be confined to their cells and in a modified program.
Have you guys mentioned anything about maybe something building up to this riot? Maybe they've noticed in the last few days or so?
At this time, we don't have that information. Our investigative services unit is currently going over as much information as they have.
Now joining us via telephone is his attorney, Keith Whatley. Keith, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Keith, tell us a little bit about who Hugo Pinnell is. Tell us a little bit about the San Quentin Six and why his case was so important.
What happened yesterday was important because of his reputation and notoriety. And the media up to now has certainly been flooded with images and statements and allegations about his actions. Many of those statements are not true, not accurate. All of them relate to allegations about him from decades ago. What doesn't make it into those reports is that he had no violence in his record at all for more than 30 years, and that after being in solitary confinement for the last 45 years, that's 4 or 5 years, prison officials finally determined that they really didn't have any basis to find him to be an active prison gang member, and they determined that he could be released from the security housing unit. However, they knew that there were specific threats against him based on his notoriety, threats from members of multiple prison gangs, active gang members, that really go back decades. I mean, they link back to a period of time when he's been bombed, he's been stabbed before, he's been shot. and these we're talking about prison-made bombs, a prison-made gun. All these things were used in attempts to kill him in decades past, and those threats have never really been resolved, and prison officials were aware of them, and we specifically asked them not to send him to a regular main line, a general population yard where they're active gang members, and instead to put him somewhere where he could safely be housed that's not a lockup unit. And they refused to do that.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of Keith Whatley. He is the attorney of Hugo Pinnell. Hugo was murdered yesterday in a California prison. Can you tell us just a little bit about the San Quentin Six in that case and Hugo's involvement in it?
I can tell you that he was at San Quentin in August 1971 in the Adjustment Center, where many people were attacked, some killed. The story that's been written and repeated many, many times is not what happened, and it would take a much longer show and much longer treatment to kind of parse that out. But Mr. Pinnell has always denied committing the acts he's convicted of, which included assaulting two of the officers. There were multiple officers who were killed on that day. He was not convicted of murder, but he was convicted of assaulting two officers at San Quentin in August 1971. And those, and that incident, because it involved George Jackson, is what has followed him and made him a marked man in many ways, and for other reasons also, because once he was marked and associated, then that also made him a target of members of other groups within the prison, other gang structures. And there have been numerous, as I said, attempts on his life over the years because of those associations and because of the reputation that he got from that.
Now, George Jackson, of course, considered himself a political prisoner. Did Hugo Pinnell consider himself a political prisoner as well?
Well, one thing about him is he didn't really get too much into the labels. He recognized that it was something that, you know, people often on the outside come up with because they want to figure out what kind of box to put him into. But he spent 45 years in a very small box and wasn't interested in trying to put himself in any other one, just because it was an easy way to think about it or look at his case. It's much more complex than that.
So how should we remember Hugo Pinnell? How should we honor the memory of the man?
Well, one of the things that that's important to note is that, again, he had no violence for more than 30 years, and that all the attention he got, all the animosity, the reason he was targeted, was all based on information about him that goes back more than 30 years, most of it more than 40 years, and that he had a sentence that was life with the possibility of parole. And he actually believed that possibility was real. He believed it when the Department of Corrections said that we no longer have any legitimate reason to keep you in the security housing unit. We're going to give you a chance to get out of here and to possibly one day get out of prison. He believed that that was a realistic possibility. He still had hope that he could rejoin his family one day. And the prison officials also promised him that they knew of these threats and that they would protect him. And they didn't do that. That hope that he had really gave him a new life, an expectation that he'd have a chance. And then the state refused to do what they were supposed to do to make sure he could be safe.
And that's the voice of our guest, Keith Whatley. He represented Hugo Pinnell, who was killed yesterday in a California state prison. The circumstances, apparently he was stabbed by another inmate. Keith, thank you so much for sharing the memory of Hugo Pinnell with us. And our hearts go out to his family and to all those prisoners who are spending unnecessary time behind bars in the state of California. Keith Whatley, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate your attention to this.
Let's go ahead and take our first break for the program today. And when we get back, we're going to talk about the Connecticut Supreme Court and its ruling reaffirming that the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Connecticut's highest court overturns the death penalty there, calling it unconstitutional. This decision spares the lives of 11 men. The state had passed a law in 2012 to repeal the death penalty only for future crimes. The ruling is in response to an appeal from a man who faced the possibility of lethal injection for a murder-for-hire killing back in 2000. His attorneys argued that any execution carried out after the repeal would be cruel and unusual punishment.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, today, the Supreme Court of the state of Connecticut overturned the death penalty. They're saying that the death penalty law in that state is unconstitutional. This is probably going to have ramifications nationally, and it's going to have ramifications here in California, where my next guest, Matt Cherry, is the executive director of an organization called Death Penalty Focus. Matt, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you.
So tell us about this ruling of the court in Connecticut and what impact it might have on the death penalty in the United States.
Sure. Well, the Connecticut Supreme Court today ruled that the death penalty violates the state constitution. And we need to remember that 3 years ago, Connecticut passed a law that ended the death penalty as a punishment for any convictions going forward. But it did not apply retroactively, which meant there were 11 men currently on death row who could still be executed. So what happened today is the state Supreme Court said that's not possible. It goes against the standards of the state constitution. It would amount to cruel and unusual punishment. And therefore, the sentences for those 11 men will be converted to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Well, how is that going to impact the efforts of organizations such as your own to try to stop the death penalty in other states?
Well, it's part of a growing national trend, and although it applies only to Connecticut, we've seen seven states in the past 8 years abolish the death penalty, and a further three states have imposed moratoriums on its use. So we're seeing that there's a steady drumbeat against the death penalty across the nation. And I think many of the states that still have the death penalty will be joining that chorus of opposition and looking to end the death penalty in their own states.
Now, I know you probably had to do this a million times and been asked it a million more, but can you just remind our listeners of the fundamental arguments that organizations like your own have against the death penalty?
Well, there's a long list of arguments, and many opponents to the death penalty have different reasons. For example, some people oppose it on moral grounds, whereas others may support it in principle, but they realize that it does not work in practice, that it is exorbitantly expensive, that it is very discriminatory in its application, and that it has the risk of executing innocent people. So there are many different reasons and many different arguments for ending the death penalty.
And what about the fundamental argument of your group, Death Penalty Focus?
Well, we try to represent everyone who questions the death penalty. So we have more than 100,000 supporters, most of them in California, and they have many different reasons. So I don't think there's one single reason that everyone shares, but I think there's a growing consensus across the nation that the death penalty is a failed experiment and needs to be abandoned.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your views today. Again, the Supreme Court of the state of Connecticut ruled yet again that the death penalty law is unconstitutional. That has been my guest, Matt Cherry. He's the executive director of Death Penalty Focus. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And let's go ahead and take another short break. When we get back, we're going to talk to an environmental activist about the resumption of uranium mining in the area of the Grand Canyon, the effect it's going to have on the environment, but also this is happening on sacred land to a First Nation tribe in that area. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And you are still listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, yesterday, a federal judge cleared the way for a mining company to begin extracting uranium ore in the Grand Canyon. This ruling comes on the heels of the Grand Canyon being named one of the most endangered sites in the world. The mining is also set to take place on land considered to be sacred by the Havasupai First Nation tribe. We're joined by Katie Davis. She's a public lands campaigner for the Center for Biological Diversity, a nonprofit activist organization based in Tucson, Arizona. Katie, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me.
So, Katie, tell us first, let's talk about the Grand Canyon and its being endangered and how this judge could rule to allow uranium mining to go forward there.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, at this point in time, and actually throughout its history, Grand Canyon, and that's both the national park and really the larger surrounding region, which is not all encompassed by the national park, has been threatened by numerous projects, whether that's housing development, uranium mining, old growth logging, various, you know, dams and diversions of the Colorado River. It's a very special place. Unfortunately, it's also seen as very potentially lucrative by many commercial interests and other interests in the region. And so this is sort of just one in a long line of threats facing Grand Canyon. And again, you know, unfortunately, based on law and regulation that we have on the books now, which in the case of uranium mining, the primary statute is the mining law from 1872. And so when we are faced with regulation in mining that takes place under a statute from the 1800s, it's quite an uphill battle to get these mines, to prevent them in the first place, to prevent them from reopening, as is the case in the Canyon mine, and to effectively prevent contamination both during and after mining. And so this case and this specific ruling was very unfortunate, and we are appealing the ruling to the Ninth Circuit. But given the law and regulation in place currently, it's actually quite an uphill battle for us and the tribes to protect public land and sacred sites from mines like this.
And so that brings up my next question, which is that this mining is going to take place in land that's considered sacred by the Havasupai First Nation tribe, right?
Yes, it's actually right next to Red Butte, which is one of the largest, if you're on the South Rim area of Grand Canyon, one of the prominent landscape features. It's sort of a little hill that sticks out, and there's a traditional name that the Havasupai tribe call that area, but we call it Red Butte, and it features prominently in their cultural lore and sacred and traditional customs, and it is, you know, that's something that this mine was actually first permitted in 1986, and there was litigation and protest by the Havasupai tribe back then, much like there was today, and it, you know, was a scar on the land then, and it's continued to be, and now, based on this decision, it's really opened the gateway for further damage to a site, and, you know, we can talk about reclamation of the surface or something like that. But when it gets into, you know, a sacred cultural site like this, there's really no way to prevent or mitigate damage that's caused when you're drilling into the land. And I think that's something that we probably, at least I know myself and others, you know, other Americans may not be able to appreciate what that means, but it certainly is very, very troubling to the Havasupai and something they've been fighting for a very long time.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of Katie Davis. She's a public lands campaigner for the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're talking about a federal judge ruling to allow more uranium mining in the Grand Canyon, despite the fact that it's considered one of the most endangered sites in the world. And also, this uranium mining is happening in the vicinity of land that's considered to be sacred by the Havasupai First Nation tribe there. Well, you know, Katie, I just want to raise an issue, which is the economic issue here. There has been tradition, but laws in the books that allow lands that are public lands that are controlled ostensibly by the federal government for the people of this country, that allows private corporations to buy the mineral rights and to begin to do things like this, to mine uranium, to extract uranium or gold or whatever other precious resources or minerals are under the ground. Why is it that private corporations are allowed, and in some cases for pennies on the dollar, to buy the rights to public lands to engage in these kinds of activities?
Well, I think, you know, this again goes back to the fact that these laws and regulations were really developed back in the early days of, you know, settlement and development of the Western United States, when the government and private interests working very hard collectively to develop and open up, economic opportunities and take advantage of what were sort of seen as unlimited resources, and to make sure that we could prosper as a country or support specific industries that needed some of these metals. Uranium in particular, of course, was very important to our sort of nuclear arms race back in, the 50s and 60s. And that, we've seen, unfortunately, the impacts from that era on other tribes in the area as well. One of the most specific, examples that I think many people know about is the impact of the Navajo Nation, continuing to this day. And what's really unfortunate, a lot of people will make the argument that this is an industry that it provides jobs in rural economies, that it's skilled labor, that it's a great way for, to create jobs or something like that. But the number of jobs created is actually very, very small, and mining is not a very large contributor to either the regional or, state economy in Arizona, compared especially to, recreation and tourism, which when you're talking about Grand Canyon is huge. I think, we're talking billions of dollars to the state annually from visitors to Grand Canyon, of course, and something like a huge uranium mine detracts from that, and also long-term creates millions, if not billions of dollars in taxpayer funding that must be used to reclaim and try to remedy many of the problems associated with mines like this. So taxpayers, certainly, and the American public, as well as tribal nations, are losing long-term. Any benefits to be gained economically are very small and very short-term.
Well, but the truth is that it does benefit greatly the few individuals and handful of corporations that are able to finagle those contracts. They get very wealthy while the taxpayer is left fitting the bill, particularly for for environmental cleanup, because uranium mining isn't exactly a clean thing, is it?
No, there's no mining that is clean at all. And, uranium mining is also a very much a boom and bust cycle industry. And what we see actually is as many of these mining companies are actually owned by foreign corporations, and they're sometimes subsidiaries or just a foreign corporation itself running a mine. So you're not even seeing American businesses that are necessarily profiting from this. But again, that's, short-term profits to people who don't live in the area, who can walk away and, given the laws that exist, are not forced to clean up or monitor or remedy many of these damaging sites that they leave behind that will haunt future generations, much like we've seen on the Navajo Nation. And so it's really just, it's such a huge expense and such a huge risk to take for, you're right, a small number, a handful of people to potentially make some money. And again, with uranium mining, that's not even guaranteed. And that's part of the reason why Canyon Mine sat sort of dormant for so long, is that the prices did not justify mining that. And so you sort of have this situation up by Grand Canyon where you have mines that are open. They may sit dormant for 20-plus years, collecting water, potentially contaminating groundwater. And then eventually, if the price gets high enough, somebody will come back and try to mine it. But it just sort of leaves this toxic legacy for everyone around the region.
Well, and it's particularly timely to talk about this, given what the EPA, what they recently did with that gold mine, right, in Colorado,
yes,
where they accidentally released
exactly
3 million gallons of toxic water into the Animas River, which is now flowing into the Colorado River, which, of course, does affect the Grand Canyon as well, right?
Yes, it will. I mean, I'm not sure exactly where it's made it on its trip down the river system. I believe at this point it may have reached Lake Powell. Of course, with any spill like that, when you have a large body of water, a lot of that will eventually settle or dilute. And, I'm not sure exactly what the EPA is doing at this point on that issue. But I think what that highlights, and I think it's sort of timely in having this conversation, is that that mine was old. EPA did obviously screw up in their handling of the situation, both when it happened and I think moving forward as well. But that's a mine that somebody, a private company used and developed and then left, basically abandoned to, for the taxpayers to deal with down the road. And that's what we've seen with uranium mining as well. And it's just sort of symptomatic of the mining industry at large, where they are not held accountable for what the mess that they leave behind. The rest of us are. And unfortunately, as in the case of this Animas spill, it's, having measurable, large economic impacts, health impacts, also to tribal nations as well. Unfortunately, I think mining and definitely uranium mining is an environmental justice issue where the least able to handle these types of problems, communities and rural areas are affected the most, and they have very little say in when the mining or where the mining happens and do not benefit really at all from these activities.
I can't even conceive of the logic of this judge, you know. the logic of this is just beyond me, Katie. I'll be honest. I just don't get it. You know, it's like, okay, well, let's add uranium mining on top of it all.
Yeah, well, you know, I really think it's one of these things. I think, and I know that the Animas disaster has also brought this to the fore again, but I think we have to have this conversation about you know, a lot of these decisions, the policy doesn't, I mean, even if the law makes sense, the policy doesn't make sense. But again, that's because we have been unable to rewrite and update laws regulating mining since the 1800s. I mean, that just to think that we have a law in the books that we're all operating under from 1872 is really just blows my mind, frankly, every time I think about it. And we have not had congressional leadership, certainly not in the Republican Party who controls the House and Senate currently, to step up and fix this for the public, for the various economic interests that depend on recreation and tourism to our public lands, for tribal nations who are impacted disproportionately by this. There's just been no congressional leadership to take control of the issue and to move us forward, and I think that is really the travesty here. I think, you know, we disagree with and we appeal many of these decisions all the time, but until we change the fundamental legal framework on which these decisions are made, it's just we're going to see a lot of this moving forward. So it's really, I think, a nationwide policy issue that needs to be addressed. And my hope is that issues like this with uranium mining near Grand Canyon and the Animas spill can really stimulate that conversation and hopefully move us forward politically as well, because I would love to see congressional leadership take up this issue and actually do something about it.
Well, you're far more optimistic to me than me. I mean, I think until they're like fish out of their fishbowl, gasping for air, only then will they think as hindsight, gosh, we should have done something about it.
Yes. So I will remain a true optimist, even though I work on so many issues that you think I would be otherwise at this point. But I really think, you know, it's unfortunate that it takes disasters for people to want to act. But I hope that, you know, as we move to an election year, as we start talking about these issues in the West, especially, which is where most of this happens, that maybe we can have some momentum and also some understanding. I think mining laws and litigation is very complex and not necessarily something that most people think about. But when it starts to directly impact your community or the national park that you visit, or, you know, if you wanted to go on a river guided trip and you can no longer do that, you know, when it starts to actually impact people, I think that they may be willing to step up and take action, and at least make sure that their congressional leadership is looking at this and thinking about it. So, you know, we may not get there this year or next year, but I think, you know, hopefully we can start building the support to make some legitimate and serious changes as we move forward.
Well, I love your spirit. It's infectious. it's a good place to leave it. But before we go, let our listeners know how they can keep track of this issue, how they can get involved to make a difference.
Yeah, so you can certainly go to our organization's website, biologicaldiversity.org. We also work with a number of partners like the Grand Canyon Trust, as well as the Havasupai Tribe. And because of this is a national issue, we should be seeing, you know, we are appealing this. We're going to, you'll see it in the national media. But we have a number of petitions that you can sign. So if you go to our website, you can sign petitions related to uranium mining. We're actually going to petition federal agencies to update some of the regulations governing uranium mining, and specifically because of the problems we've seen with Canyon Mine. So I really recommend that people check out our website, Google it if you just want to start somewhere. Just start, you know, educating yourself on the issues and keep up to date, and hopefully with enough public support nationwide and actually around the world on this issue, we can make some progress.
Well, again, that is Katie Davis. She is with the Center for Biological Diversity. Katie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, no, thank you.
Well, it's that time again, another short break. And when we return, we're going to go back to the issue of Haiti and the unrest that is left in the wake of many irregularities and violence that were reported this past Sunday during parliamentary elections there. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on Flashpoints. Are still still listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we're going to turn our attention back to Haiti and the recent parliamentary elections there. The first parliamentary elections held under Michel Martelly, which were greatly delayed. They were supposed to be held in 2011, but now we're hearing voices of contention that, in fact, there were many irregularities to the voting. The Conseil Electoral Provisoire, which is the election council in Haiti, said that only then less than 5% of the polling stations were affected by irregularities and violence. However, we're hearing now from other organizations that it could be as high as 50%. Now joining us is the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, Brian Concannon. Welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Kevin. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. Hey, so give us just sort of your first general impressions about the parliamentary elections. Maybe give us a sense of how many folks on the ground IJDH was working with to sort of monitor the process.
So the elections happened on Sunday, and they were national. They were first round for parliament. We worked with a coalition of people. We had a couple of our own people on the ground, but it was mostly working with other grassroots groups and some progressive American observers, but also just trying to monitor everything, social media, internet, radio reports, and things like that. And the reason why we felt it was important to monitor it was that in the past, as Flashpoints listeners know, there's been a great discrepancy between what happens on the ground and what gets reported in the mainstream press and by the large governments. And we felt that that was a risk for these elections, and that certainly turned out to be the case.
Well, in what way did that turn out to be the case? Can you give us some sense of what occurred with the reports that you guys did compile of what actually happened on Election Day?
So right from the very beginning, when the polls started opening at 6 o'clock in the morning, there were reports from a broad range of sources, foreign media in Haiti, Haitian media, grassroots groups from a range of political perspectives, political parties. Pretty much everyone was saying, here we're having serious problems. We're having voting centers that aren't opening. We're having voting centers that are being closed down by violence. There's lots of intimidation. A lot of voters who feel they can't vote. And throughout the day, we're hearing this fairly consistent and building group of very troubling reports. And then when you started getting the responses from the international community, especially the European Union Observation Mission and the UN Peacekeeping Mission and some U.S.-financed observation delegations, all they were reporting was good news. And not that good news wasn't happening. There were lots of places people were able to vote, but there were so many places where they weren't that it was raising red flags for anybody who was serious. And it was clear that these people were ignoring the red flags in order to downplay that violence. And I think that the epitome of that was when the head of the European Union said that the elections were operating in near perfect normalcy. And this was done in the late afternoon when it was clearly documented on all platforms that there were serious problems.
So, Brian, let's get into some of the specifics of the allegations of violence that occurred on Sunday during the parliamentary elections. What were some of those incidences that you were hearing?
It started the night before the polls when there were several voting centers that were actually burnt down. It had been building in the few weeks before the election. There were several incidents of attacks of political party candidates and supporters, and even of electoral offices in regional capitals. But on the election day, it started off with burning down in the early morning of some voting centers, and it continued throughout the day. The main problems were political party supporters, and some of them officially accredited, who were engaged in discussions that got out of hand, became violent. In many cases, the voting centers were trashed and ballots were dispersed all over the place. We don't know if that was used as a cover for ballots to be actually stolen. We have heard reports of candidates coming with guns and forcing voting center supervisors to accept pre-marked ballots. There were, I believe, three people who were killed in the day, including one political party activist who was doing get-out-the-vote activities. So there's certainly a lot of specific incidents, but what is probably even more concerning is the impact that these incidents had on other voters. So obviously, if a voting center was closed, you had anywhere from 5 to 20,000 people who weren't allowed to vote there. But that probably also impacted many other people at other voting centers who decided it wasn't safe to vote that they were going to stay home because of the violence.
So this was being announced as these attacks were happening at polling stations and the ones from the previous evening. These are being announced over Haitian media on the morning and the day of the election. So people were hearing that there was this violence out there. And I guess the argument is that this couldn't help but have an impact on whether people went to the polls or not.
Especially in the context of Haiti, where, as you know, there's a history of electoral violence. And in fact, one of the places that was closed down the earliest was the Argentine Bellegarde School on Rue Vaillant, which was the site of a very notorious massacre in 1987 elections. So, yeah, this was obviously going through voters' heads, and I think it did have an impact on voters coming out and participating on that day.
Now, let's talk about the poll watchers. Traditionally, parties that are involved in a contest, an electoral contest, will be able to have representatives at various polling stations, if not all of them, in order to sort of make sure that everything is done properly and correctly, that their party gets a fair shake. Now, I understand that did not happen during these elections.
Yeah, the general theory is that if you have people representing a broad enough spectrum of parties, that they will supervise each other and prevent fraud from happening. But there are ways of gaming the system, and what a lot of groups traditionally in the past have been trying to get people basically representing them, even if they formally represent another party. And in this case, accreditations were not delivered in time. A lot of parties said they never got them or only got a few of them. From a pretty broad spectrum of reports, the two parties that did not have problems with their accreditations were a party called Bouclier and a party called PHTK, both of which are associated with Haiti's president, Martelly. And so there are many parties, especially on the left side of the spectrum, who are saying that they were unable to get their mandataires into many key places, and that there is a deep concern that allowed the mandataire process to be gamed, which would allow fraud to happen in the voting booth without anybody complaining about it.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of our guest, Brian Concannon, with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. We're discussing this past Sunday's parliamentary elections that occurred there. Well, it sounds as if PHTK, President Michel Martelly's party, and the Associated Party Bouclier had an advantage. But isn't it true they also had an advantage prior to the elections with campaigning during the campaign time?
They certainly had an obvious advantage in resources. No one's quite sure where that advantage came. Many people are saying it's from the government, and there actually is proof that some of it came from the government in the sense that government vehicles were cited at campaign events. But many people believe that government funds were taken to pay for posters and things like that, that those two parties had and that none of the other parties were able to put up. The Haiti's elections are supposed to have a public financing component, but in this case, there were two problems with that. One, it was delivered late, in less than a week before the election, so that really didn't allow parties to use that money well for these elections. And second, the president has packed the amount of parties. There's an absurd amount of parties in Haiti. It's over 100 that were participating in these elections. Most of them have no chance of winning any of the seats. Over half of them, by most estimates, are in one way or another connected with President Martelly. And so people suspect the president and his associates of gaming the system of campaign financing by just having parties that are out there that will get their share of the money, even though they have no chance of realistically winning. And that takes the money away from the other parties that are poorly financed but have popular support.
Now, it seems that part of what also gives credibility to a lot of the arguments of the irregularities and the violence and the unfairness of these elections is that President Michel Martelly himself is, there's continuing scandal swirling around him and his administration, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And you know, if you look at the whole context, you look at these things, that the violence seems to be disproportionately done by the president's associates, that they apparently gained the mandataire system and the public financing system, that a lot of the places where voting was closed down are in places where the government is not expected to do well. And then you put it in the context of no elections at all for 4 years and a series of financial and other scandals breaking out within the president's party. There seems to be a fairly strong pattern that this is an attempt to prolong a very troubling regime for another 5 years through electoral manipulation.
Well, and it also seems that from all indications that the U.S. government, that the Obama administration is not going to have a problem with these elections, that in fact they are leading the chorus saying that the irregularities were too small, that overall these were good elections.
Again, this fits the longer pattern. This has been happening for 4 years, that every time that there has been well-documented reports of problems by the government, especially its attempt to manipulate the electoral process, the U.S. government has always downplayed that, and it's downplayed the opposition. They've always tried to say, oh, it's only a very small minority of people in Haiti who are opposing the government, which is time and again demonstrated that that's not true, that most civil society in Haiti and most political parties with demonstrated electoral success do want the fair elections. But it does appear that the U.S. government, along with the European Union, the Organization of American States, and the international community in general in Haiti, is willing to go along with the problematic elections and also willing to openly try to downplay the very serious problem.
Now, of course, there are presidential elections, which are coming October the 25th, and that's considered the really big prize for the parties that are contesting the elections, more than 50 parties running. I'm just wondering, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but I'm wondering your learned opinion. Where's this going to go at this point? Where do we go out of this sort of scandal swirling around these parliamentary elections? And, of course, I think there's going to be a lot to be said when the results are announced on the 19th, I believe, right? August the 19th?
Yeah, that's really what's at stake. And I think that in many ways these elections are precursors to the next round of election. And if violence is allowed to go unchecked, if gaming the system through public financing and through the observer system is allowed to happen, it's going to happen again next time at a much larger level, and you're going to have even more distortions in an election where the stakes are going to be much higher. And so that's why people in Haiti are taking to the streets, they're taking to the airwaves, they're writing reports. There's a real strong effort by grassroots groups, political parties, and civil society organizations to really make sure that the word is out there that these are problems and that they need to be fixed before the next election.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Again, that's the voice of our guest, Brian Kincannon. Brian is with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. They had observers. They were watching closely the electoral process that took place this last Sunday, August the 9th, in Haiti for Parliament. Brian, we're going to get back to you, and we're going to keep on this story. We appreciate you filling us in today on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Well, I appreciate you covering Haiti so well.
And now let's go ahead and listen to this special report filed by Nora Barrows Friedman and the Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In London, I'm Ace Stanley with the Electronic Intifada podcast. Jeremy Corbyn, the surprise frontrunner in the leadership election for the UK's Labour Party, says he would impose a two-way arms embargo on Israel if he were to become Prime Minister in 2020. In a recent interview with the Electronic Intifada, the Member of Parliament for Islington in central London endorsed key elements of the boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign against Israel. Corbyn is a patron of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign and is well known as an active supporter of Palestinian rights. We sat down to talk about his background in activism and his political views, including his support for the Palestinian right of return. I began by asking him how he became involved with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign.
Must have been a long time ago now.
Always been very aware of the issues facing the Middle East, going back to the 67 war as a child in school, and what was happening then, and then later on the formation of the PLO and Palestine issues, and then in Parliament later on, became an MP in 83, became involved much more in the Palestine cause, and since then I've been involved in the formation of the PSC as an amalgamation of a number of other Palestinian campaigns and groups, and later became a patron of the PSC. I have visited Palestine and Israel 9 times, and I've also visited Lebanon and Syria, and visited a lot of Palestinian refugee camps during my life, and also, of course, met Palestinian representatives in Egypt, Tunisia, and in a number of Latin American countries when I've been visiting. There's a very big Palestinian diaspora.
Yeah, in Latin America there's a big
one. Huge, particularly in Chile, and it's no accident that the Latin American governments that all supported recognition of Palestine in part were prompted to do this by the size of the Palestinian diaspora in all countries.
Yeah. So you mentioned becoming a lot more involved when you entered Parliament in 1983, and that was, of course, not long after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 82. What would you say since then, between 83 and now, has been the biggest change you've seen in the solidarity movement?
A growing scepticism about Israel's justification for the siege of Gaza, the continuing occupation of the West Bank and the growth of settlements, growing understanding of the cause of Palestinian people, and during Operation Cast Lead, for example, I was at the demonstration which was opposed to the bombing by Operation Cast Lead, and 200,000 people came, biggest ever demonstration in support of Palestinian rights outside of Palestine anywhere in the world, I think.
Yeah.
And that was in London.
Just talk a little bit about the hustings at the JW3 Centre, the leadership hustings not very long ago, which was organised by Labour Friends of Israel and some other groups. During that hustings, you were critical of British arms sales to Israel. As leader of the opposition, if you win, I mean, how would you push for those arms sales to end in opposition?
The hustings was interesting, yeah, and absolutely legitimate to hold it, and I was very happy to have the opportunity to discuss position. I wish the hustings had been a bit longer, but there was an issue of a vote in Parliament.
Yeah.
And I wish there'd been more interaction and discussion. Indeed, I encourage that the JW3 do promote that kind of interaction and discussion, and I genuinely hope that they do. At the moment, some arms sales are restricted already by Britain to Israel under the licensing arrangements. The Parliamentary Committee, the Quadripartite Committee on Monitoring of Arms Sales, has raised concerns about the use of some of the equipment that is sold to Israel. Sir John Stanley, the outgoing chair of it, was certainly very, very critical of Israel's behaviour in Gaza and in the occupied territories. I think we have to push robustly for the limitation of arms supplies, and in particular observation of the human rights clauses of the European Union-Israel trade agreement, which I believe Israel to be in breach of. Israel is, after all, facing an investigation by the Human Rights Council for Geneva Convention, for war crimes, as indeed are the Hamas forces on a much different or lesser scale, should we say, but they are facing it also. And I think we should be very cautious about supplying arms in those circumstances, and I've said so and will continue to say so.
I thought the Conservative government had they'd done a review and they concluded that everything that they were supplying was okay.
I'm not sure that all licences have been reactivated, but certainly the trajectory of the Conservative government is to approve of continuous arms sales. It's not my position, because they are continuing with the imprisonment of children, elected parliamentarians, expulsion of African asylum seekers from Israel, and of course the siege of Gaza, refusing to allow any reconstruction equipment to go through, and continuing the settlement policy on the West Bank, and indeed still trying to sell settlement products as if they're Israeli products through Western markets, even though that's been declared completely illegal by the European Union.
So would you push in opposition for a further review of arms licences?
Absolutely, I would push for that. I can't give chapter and verse on what the details of the current restrictions are on arms sales, but yes, I would, because I do think we've got to be serious about encouraging a peace process, and a peace process will come about when Israel understands that there is not a military solution on option. The only option is actually one of talks that involve everybody. Indeed, the former head of Mossad himself has said that there should be talks involving Hamas.
War on Want and the Campaign Against the Arms Trade have both called for the imposition of a two-way arms embargo on Israel. Amnesty has called for an arms embargo. As Prime Minister, would you implement one?
Yes, because it seems to me, unless something... unless something fundamentally changes, we get a genuine peace process going on, we get an agreement with the Palestinian people, and we get full recognition of the state of Palestine, then quite clearly the issues that arise now for the call of an arms embargo seem to me to be there just the same. I'm not quite sure why they say a two-year arms embargo.
Two-way, like...
I beg your pardon.
Israeli sales, sales to this country and British arms sales to Israel.
A two-way arms embargo, absolutely, because we do import some weaponry from Israel, particularly very high technical weaponry from Israel, and I don't think we should.
You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Visit us online at electronicintifada.net or follow us on Twitter at Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
Intifada Electronic.
Intifada Electronic.
Electronic Intifada.
Elbit, Britain's largest arms firm, has got four subsidiary factories operating in the United Kingdom. As you mentioned, they're mostly involved in high tech. One is involved in optics and targeting. One is involved in parts for drones, drone engines. There's campaigners who are calling for them to be shut down. Do you agree with them?
I'm opposed to the use of drones. Indeed, Tom Watson, one of the candidates for deputy leader, is chair of the all-party group on drones. They are calling for that as well. I agree with them on that. The question of drones, their use, the civilian casualties that result from them, the many inaccuracies of drone attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan indicate that they're nothing like the high-tech super weapon that they claim to be. They're actually a bomb, just like any other.
So would you push for these factories to be shut down or converted?
Converted. I am not in favour of making people redundant because they work in the arms industry. I'm in favour of using a national investment bank in order to invest in socially useful products. We've got brilliant high-tech engineers working on defence who could just as easily be working on civilian aircraft or civilian ships or civilian helicopters.
So we've spoken about the arms trade with Israel. What do you make of the other areas of the BDS campaign? For example, Palestinian calls for a boycott of Israeli academic institutions. Almost all Israeli institutions on the academic institutions on the official level are involved in the occupation in some level. And also there's calls for complicit not all Israeli artists, but those Israeli cultural bodies that are officially endorsed by the army, for example, or as part of Brand Israel, has caused to boycott them. What do you make of those kind of strategies?
The economic relationship of settlement goods and so on is a fairly straightforward one. The academic boycott issue is very complicated because I would not want to prevent people like Ilan Pappe coming here to speak in this country. I would not want to stop serious academics that have studied the issue, studied the history of it, from whatever point of view, actually coming and taking part in it. But if it is a university that is doing research into drones, taser weapons, or doing research into surveillance of the occupation in Gaza and elsewhere, then they should be part of the boycott. And so I think it has to be quite specific that it is a boycott relating to the occupation of the West Bank, the siege of Gaza, and the treatment of Palestinian people. But I think having a serious dialogue with academics who are looking at historical issues and social issues surrounding it has got to be a good thing, and it's quite difficult to lay down regulation of how you deal with that. And so I would want us to have a boycott of those that are involved in occupation activities.
Yeah. The European Union, what do you think explains quite often uniformly pro-Israel policies that we see within the European Union so often?
There is a general view amongst older people all across Europe that the Jewish people suffered so abominably, so vile was the Holocaust and all that went with it, that the establishment of the State of Israel was the right thing to do. It exists, it's there. And that therefore there should be a lot of latitude given towards the State of Israel. it's younger people and a wider audience that often have a rather different view on this. But the European Union member states, the majority of whom are now either themselves recognising or calling for the recognition of the state of Palestine, things have changed a great deal, and I would hope the European Union will change with it and the European Parliament will vote to recognise Palestine.
When there's currently efforts, you know, to make sure that the EU on an institutional level and that member states have to merely start labelling settlement goods, not even banning them, and there just seems to be a lot of institutional opposition to that.
Well, there is, and there was institutional opposition to any other kind of consumer boycott, but this is a serious matter. These products are produced on illegally occupied land, on water that's been taken illegally from the Palestinian people, and the Palestinian people themselves don't have the same export opportunities for their products. And I think it's right that we're very tough on it, and we should end the sale of settlement products. Indeed, the numbers are on sale are reducing because of the effectiveness of the campaign.
What do you think is the ultimate solution? Do you see a one-state solution as likely in the long term?
Well, at the moment, all that's on offer is the possibility of a two-state solution. The two-state solution is difficult to see how it would operate with the degree of settlements that are there. It's 500,000 people Israel would have to move out of the settlements in order to get an agreement with Palestine and a two-state solution. They did move the settlements out of Gaza, albeit a smaller number, after the withdrawal from Gaza. They could and should do the same, but the Netanyahu government appears to be moving exactly the opposite direction.
Yeah,
of more settlements. I think it's up to the people of the region to decide what kind of long-term solution there would be. Listen, the lines on the map were drawn in London and Berlin and Vienna. The mandates were given out at the Treaty of Versailles in Paris. The secret deal between Britain and France was done in 1916 in the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The Balfour Declaration came a year later. I think it's time that Europe understood the problems that have been created by European colonial mentality in the past and allow the people of the region to decide their future. We should therefore recognise Palestine, try and bring about that longer-term peace process and develop it from there. We've got to move on, and the three areas of Palestine that have got to be addressed are: one, settlements and occupation of the West Bank; two, the siege of Gaza; and three, the issue of now fourth generation refugees living in camps in Lebanon and some still in Syria. They deserve their rights too. They deserve their right to return home.
So you support the right of return of the Palestinian refugees?
Yes, I do, because that's got to be the key to it. Whether they want to return or not is another matter, but yeah, there has to be.
It's about the rights, isn't it?
The rights have to be there. And can there be a settlement? Yeah, I think there can be, because the economic price, the social price and the life price of not having one is so huge.
Last question is, do you read the Electronic Intifada?
Sometimes.
Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Watkins, out of Baltimore, took over his brother's drug selling when his brother got killed. He grew up in the game, put himself through Johns Hopkins while dealing. Now, D. Watkins is a community college professor with an explosive new book called The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. It's all about police violence, the prison industrial complex, the collapse of education in the inner city. D. Watkins will be at First Congregational Church in Oakland at 2501 Harrison Street on Tuesday, September 22nd, 7:30 p.m. There's free parking and wheelchair access at this KPFA benefit. I'm Greg Bridges, and I'll be hosting. You can get tickets at brownpapertickets.com or at Marcus Books or other bookstores. Full info is on kpfa.org for Eloquent Brother D. Watkins, September 22nd.
This is KPFA, KPFB Berkeley 88.1.